from PRX.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and our friends beyond the binary, it's time for the podcaster that puts the board in load commenda. It's time for Sleep With Me. That didn't make any sense, I know, but it's a podcast that puts you to sleep. All right, but Scoot's here, and this is where I talk about, like, just supporting the show. So this is really only for regular listeners. If you count on Sleep With Me or you use Sleep With Me on a regular basis, you're a long-term listener. Like, does Sleep With Me do anything unique for you, right? Is it a part of your life in it's a unique way? Like, when you just discovered the show or it started helping you, you're like, wow, I had no idea this existed, but I was looking for it. And then does it provide something for you? Is it unique and does it provide something? Does it do anything for you? Like, does it help you fall asleep or take your mind off of stuff so you could fall asleep? Or does it keep you company? Does it distract you during the day? So is it unique or somewhat unique? And does it do anything for you? If the answer is yes to both of those, like, how much is that? Is that worth anything to you? How much are those things, the unique part and whatever it does for you, worth to you? But the other question is, like, if Sleep With Me went away, like, what would you be willing, like, would that change what it's worth to you? Would it change the value proposition? To get it back, oh yeah, I'd pay $50 a month, and you don't even have a tier at that level. So just think about that. But if any of that resonates with you, don't wait. We really are in a position now where for at least a time, I'm going to have to kind of really work hard to get more people involved in supporting the show. We have the listeners. It's just getting the attention of enough listeners, a small percentage of people, but people that are said, okay, I'll do it now. You just go to sleepwithmepodcast.com/plus and sign up, support the show. Even if you're not sure, sign up for all the trials are 7 days, and then you could change your mind. But at least then you've done something. You said, yes, it's unique. Yes, it really means something to me. Yes, it does something for me. And no, I don't want to wait. Like, I don't want it to go away. So thanks. Think about that. sleepwithmepodcast.com/plus. sleepwithmepodcast.com/plus.
To put you to sleep, we do it with a bedtime story. All you need to do is get in bed, turn out the lights, and press play. I'm going to do the rest. And if it's your first 60 or 70 times here, you might be wondering, what's the rest? I said, well, geez, let me explain to you. What I'm going to do is create a safe place. And within that safe place, or even on the periphery of a safe place, how about that use of a word? And, you know, I don't think I just jinxed myself, though, because... So there'll just be some word botching coming right up. That's one of my methods, but let me explain what I use word botching for. I create a safe place, and within the safe place, or on the periphery of the safe place, 2 for 2 on periphery, make it 3 for 3. You could set aside whatever's keeping you up at night, whether it's thinking, feeling, external noises, physical sensations, coulda, woulda, shouldas, the stuff you're supposed to do tomorrow, you're traveling, you're in transit, or you're just, like, you know, really excited about, you say you're going on vacation tomorrow. Well, God bless you, I'd be excited too, I understand. So what I'm going to try to do is take your mind off of stuff. I'm going to use techniques like the newly christened word botching. But that's something I've been using all along. I just didn't have a term for it. Lulling, soothing tones, wings of pointlessness. What do we call? I thought we had a witty term for pregnant pauses. I just used gratuitous pregnant pauses. I think, yeah, and those were. I just stuck a few in there and it helped me remember. Oh, yeah. If you stick a couple gratuitous pregnant pauses in there, you'll remember that they're gratuitous. And also, the more pauses you do, the less words you botch. I said, wow, this is like, I got some teamwork going on in my brain right now. But if you're really new here, and indulge me, because in all honesty, I'm just trying to take your mind off stuff to put you to sleep. These intros, yeah, they go on. I try to introduce the concept of the show in a new way every single time.
And actually, this is a new theory. I mean, it's an old theory. I just don't always put it forth. But I think one of the keys to the podcast is somehow finding a familiarity and a variety at the same time. And so that's why I make the intros, because some people, they fall asleep during the intro, and that's a good thing. Now, there's a tiny sliver of the population, mostly goons, G-O-O-N-S, and hooligans. I can tell by the nasty things they write that they don't like the intros, they or me. But that's fine, because, they don't need to sleep. You know, they're just returning from a hooliganing anyway. And then they accidentally encounter my packet. So it's not meant to be, so it's not a big deal. But the intros, it's trying to find a balance of something. They say, oh, okay, Scooter's going to try to make it's not a misguided metaphor. And again, it's not a gratuitous, I guess sometimes there are gratuitous metaphors, just like those gratuitous pregnant pauses. Gratuitous use of the word gratuitous, and what was the word I used? Periphery. Just on the periphery of sensibility. I mean, that's where this podcast lies. So that way, if you're new here, you'll kind of get you'll know pretty soon. If you say, well, I'm not a hooligan, but you make me feel like one. I say, okay, maybe you could bail, and no harm done. Thanks for your time. If you're unsure or you're suspicious, you're skeptical, give it a few tries. I hope it works for you. What I was saying is I think a lot of the parts for me that could start up are thinking parts or worrying parts or to-do listers, it's the actual part of me, and it's a metaphorical or relatable part to the 80 other parts of me that get stirred up at bedtime, but they all get stirred up. And the whole thing is, I'm not really entertaining, super entertaining to regular people, to humans, or to the central humanity unit inside you. I try to avoid all philosophy and that kind of stuff. So I don't want to say the you or whatever, because I said, geez, I have no idea. So let's just use a straightforward metaphor. It's a CMH, or Central Humanity Unit, Central H Humanity Unit. Yeah, your CHU. Right in there in the soul chasm or whatever wherever they install it, that part of you, that part of you will actually, ideally, it'll go into sleep mode, because they say, okay, this is a little bit of nonsense, but the vibrations, it'll just vibrate your encasing of your CMH or whatever the heck I called it, Central Humanity Unit. So that all the other components within, the little other, I call them brain bots. I don't know if they necessarily fit this schema of the human makeup, but I'm entertaining to all those other things. We'll say there's a little, I don't know. Once you get I guess I should have finished with the central, once you get a central humanity unit or whatever, you say, well, what else do you need? And he said, well, she said, yeah, I don't know why I don't know why they installed all the other parts. Because, if you take a few steps back, you start to see all these dials. And you get steam-powered stuff on one side. You get some vacuum tubes. You get some solid state. You get some stuff with different, nocturnal gerbils running wheels. You get that strange guy that you're pretty sure is a part of your personality riding a bike or turning a light bulb on. And those, all those different things are letting out alerts and signals. And you say, well, geez, don't I just need this central humanity unit? What's all this other stuff? Well, that's the rest of you. I don't know. I'm sure there's, you find better. Well, let's set aside all that right now. But what I try to do is I go in the room and your central humanity, let's just say that, I roll into that utility closet, the central humanity unit's up against the back wall. And I guess because it has eyes. Again, I don't know who the heck designed this thing. They say, well, why'd you put eyes on the central humanity unit? Because then it can see all the other buzzing and lighting stuff, and it can't go to sleep. And you say, well, I roll in and you see me. And that's a familiar part of the show. You say, well, Scoots. And usually even at the Central Humanity, you let us sound like that. You know, they say, oh, Scoots is on. You know, okay, so I could slowly start to roll down. But then all the other beeping and whirring and tinkling contraptions, we'll call them, lovely contraptions, yes, you all are. They recognize me. Say, oh, it says Scoots Goofball. He's going to do some like goofing around for us. Usually he'll, I mean, this is behind the scenes. This is my other podcast. It's a straight podcast just for these creatures, you know, not for a Central Humanities unit. Usually I do poor magic tricks. And they seem, I could just do that for 8 hours every night for that part of you. And I say, for my next trick, and they already know I've never completed a magic trick. But luckily, I've spent $4 million on packaged magic tricks. So then I say, you know, I'm going to make these balls disappear. But, and you know, I work in some routines in there. And that's kind of what the podcast is. But see, there's a variety. Because I think if there has to be this familiarity, but also this variety, because otherwise, you know, your Central Humanity Unit still got those eyes on there. And if I just did the same four magic tricks, you know, all those parts of you would be like, all the other parts of the vacuum tubes particularly are sensitive to this. And of course, the gerbils and all of them, they say, oh, no, you did the one with the red balls, the foam balls before. And I said, well, no, this one's with rainbow handkerchiefs. Ooh. Have I ever told you the tale of the double rainbow handkerchiefs? And that's pretty much how this podcast works, but it's more in a just a narrative, you know, more like a Las Vegas, you know, not as good as a good Las Vegas magic show. Usually it has like a overriding narrative, you know, to connect all the tricks. I think it's never had the scratch to see one. To see Chris Angel or David Copperfield, David Blaine. You know, but that'd be cool. But enough about me. Oh, boy, where did that come from, Scoots? Holy forlorn magician problem. Okay, sorry about that, folks. It just sprung right out of me. Yet another issue, yet another nonsensical issue for me to deal with in my personal life. Let me just tamp that back down there. Sorry about that. But so... But, you know, I'll be trying to do a story for the rest of the show. We'll do a little housekeeping, and then we'll move on to talking about Game of Thrones, and I'll run through a segment talking about the episode. Then I'll talk about some stuff I learned on the show. But it'll be a little bit lighthearted. It'll be sanitized. It'll be fun. And then the episode will be capped off with a visit from Tommen and Sir Pounce, and I'll talk to the old gods and the new. And the whole thing is to just take your mind off of stuff, let you ease off, keep the attention of those parts of you that are more alert-based or like your no. I guess those are different. It's like, why do you, again, not to criticize the master architect or whatever the heck it is. If you have the Central Humanities Processing Unit, you know, what the heck do you have 50 notification centers for? And then, okay, that central architect literally just tapped me on the shoulder. I wish I had a video podcast that said, so you could do something with your life, Scoots. And I said, well, you really do know what you're doing. Holy, you were so brilliant, central architect. Sorry about that passive-aggressive thing 5 seconds ago. Yeah, that's where old Scoots comes in. I take them, I don't want to call them lesser parts of you. They're what did we call them? The gizmos. There's gizmos in that room, too. Contraptions. Diddlies and things like that. What do you call them? Infernal devices. I think that was another term I've heard. So that's what I'll do for the next, and these Game of Thrones episodes are a little longer than normal, so I'll be here for a while. And the thing is, you don't have to fall asleep. I'll actually be putting in a full effort, just like I said with that magician type metaphor. I'll be wholeheartedly doing it, you know, just like a good amateur magician does. And that's one of my things that I love is like, even if they're terrible, if they're doing it with a joy
in a full, like where they're fully involved, there's something wonderful about that, you know. And especially me, because, you know, I'm slobbing my words or whatever, you know. And they say, well, yeah, it's a bit like, a, you know, watching somebody spill Kool-Aid on themselves while they're drinking. I said, well, that's what I do in my spare time, so. Basically what I'm saying is I'm glad you're here. I appreciate you stopping by. And I really yearn and I really desire to help you fall asleep, so I hope I can. And thank you for testing this show out, or thank you for keep coming back, all right? Let's keep this bag of goofy tricks going. And then on to the housekeeping. Sleep With Me podcast on web, sleepwithmepodcast.com. Older episodes are there. You can comment on the website. You can email me feedback at Sleep With Me podcast on Twitter at Dear Scooter or on Facebook. I want to thank Carl W., who edited this episode, Chris Posty Posterson, who does the theme music, Scotty and Jennifer on the artwork, on the honor, and Jonathan Mann, who provides the lullabies. And you can get a custom lullaby or a song from Jonathan Mann at jonathanmann.net. We've got a Facebook group. I want to thank the moderators over there, Alexandra, Laura, Lie to Lie, Jennifer B. and Julie C. It's at sleepwithmepodcast.com/Reddit. I want to thank all the patrons over at sleepwithmepodcast.com/patron over on Patreon that are slowly we're coming together there. And I think that's it. Let's get on to the show.
Sleep With Me is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Sleep With Me comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting your time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/withme. That's odoo.com/withme. Odoo, modern management made simple.
All right, everybody, we're talking season 4, episode 6, Book of the Stranger tonight. And tonight, you know, everybody can't, no one could see how I'm recording it, but tonight I have an extra layer of, so now I've got three, I got my notes in front of me, I have some dialogue from the show in front of me, and then I have on an old iPhone 4S Game of Thrones playing before. Because I used to have to switch back on the iPad. And I said, well, geez, let's play the episode right through. Like, sometimes I would do that, but then I'd have to... Anyway, it's an experiment. But we're talking season 4. I'll probably be more distracted, maybe, but who cares? We're talking season 4. It'll give me another thing to reference, I guess. Book of the Stranger. And... Oh yeah, I'm distracted. I'm looking at the hilt of the Jon Snow's sword, and Ned's picking it up here. I guess I could do that, but that would be just straight narration, which is kind of dull. So I'm gonna try to distract myself with the notes I took. Oh, so it opens with swords. It's Jon's, but Ned looks at it in its sheath. And he's thinking, John's packing, and Ned seems very torn, and I capitalized T-O-R-N-N. Actually, it looks like I only capitalized T-R-N-N with an exclamation point. And then Ned has like a serious and brave look. John's saying, hey, I'm out. He's like, well, where are you going to go? You know, we've been together. How can you leave us? You know, that's why he's torn. He's like, what are you doing, man? And John says, yeah, Ed says, you swore your life. I thought his name was Ned, but it turns out it's Ed. I don't know if I came clean on that last week. I've been calling him. And actually, for most of the podcasts, I've had his name wrong. Then someone had the kindness to email me. Because I think for a while I was calling him, hey, who's that other guy? But then he's the only guy, you know. I think his name's like Delirious or something, Ned with a D word. Anyway, he says, you got a vow. John says, yeah, I had a vow, but that was old Jon Snow. This is new Jon Snow. And these guys, they went against me. Would you want me to stay here? And then we have one horn blows, which I always forget the night. I know, and one horn means somebody's there, I think. And then let's read my notes. Then I'm going to actually watch the scene. This is one of the scenes I wanted to watch. Brienne, some word. Oh, Brienne and Sansa. Oh, Sansa's on the left. The gate's open. They say open the gates, and then the gates open, and Brienne's there. Sansa's on the left. Podrick's on the right. There's mountains behind them. According to my notes, they kind of trudge in on the horses. And Brienne looks, and I definitely can't read it because I overwrote. It's in parentheses. Looks like S-C-O-N. Looks scared, maybe scorn. Maybe she has scorn on her face. Yeah, her face definitely has something. Then her and Tormund share this look. I'm playing it now. They go in. Everybody's watching them come in. The camera's going back and forth, and Tormund's just staring and looking at him. He's totally, his jaw's on the floor as they come in. He looks flabbergasted. Then her and Tormund share look number one. That's what I put. This is what everybody's talking about this week anyway, so I don't want to over-talk it. But I put he looks flabbergasted, which he did. Sansa looks around. She turns. John's standing up. He takes his hand off the rail. I really like it. Like, almost like the rail was too cold. He takes his hand off the rail. Another nice, nice touch. Look at my notes, actually, are better at describing stuff than watching it. Because that was a good thing I noticed the other time. Then he walks down, and he's got this look. She's got this look. This is really good non-spoken acting by both of them. I can see why Kit Harington's such a lead, you know, lead actor after this, just the looks. And then actually Brienne was giving side eyes during that scene. They hug in the snow. And believe it or not, I'm giving notes slower than the episode. The episode's getting way ahead of me. Yeah, but who cares? It's not my job. Let it run, I say. You know. But they have a hug in the snow. Then they're in the, like, they're in a private dining room. And they're having soup and ale in front of the fire. And, they're making amends, her and John. Forgive me. And they're just talking about, you know, how they treated each other. She was kind of awful. He was like, well, I was always sulking in the corner. And I said, well, there's nothing to forgive. And this is something, and they say, no, forgive me. And he said, all right, I forgive you. And then they laugh. Then they share a drink of bad beer. And then they say, well, we're in this together, but how are we going to, Sansa wants to go home. And then John's like, I don't know about that. And Sansa's already like, well, how many wildlings do you got? And I say, well, it's not in it. And she goes, hey, they owe you, John. She goes, Winterfell is our home. It belongs to our family. We got to go after it. And he goes, I'm tired of Sansa. I'm tired of this. And he goes, all I've done is fight since I left home, you know. And I've lost a lot. And I've seen a lot. And even people I've admired. And he goes, you know, it's a lot. And she goes, well, this is what we have to do. You know, it's a family. Now she's starting to sound like a Lannister. You know, this is a family. I mean, I don't think she says family, but
She's kind of talking about her own their security. And she says, you know what, I'll do it myself if I have to. Let's see what else I have. Forgive me, you go, we go. Home. Sansa's the are with Edge works the room. Oh, there's a lot of good working in the room here. Like Sansa stands up. You can really learn a lot about, I mean, I don't know. Tired of fighting, I've fought and I've lost. Then there's a parenthesis here. I don't know why, but it says WTF Onion Night Lesson. Oh, I fought and I've lost. Oh, that's why I was irritated, because he said, didn't you take that life lesson from the Onion Knight? Keep fighting. Keep, like, making mistakes and recovering from your mistakes. Onion Knight's middle name's Resilience. What are these called? We're not in the aughts anymore. So what is this called? The Diaz's or something? But he's so into, you know, resiliency is so... I mean, I guess it was hot a couple of years ago. It's making a comeback, though. Get it? That was a minor resiliency joke. Okay, I'll just wait and see if anybody gets resiliency. It's making a comeback. Okay. Onion Knight would get it, because the Onion Knight's big on that. But then there's a scene with the Onion Knight. Red Woman's looking, and then he kind of does this a little... After I talked him up, Red Woman's kind of looking thoughtfully out, and she looks kind of sad and thoughtful. And Davos goes up to her, and he's probing her. He goes, where are you going to go? And she goes, well, wherever Jon Snow goes, I'm doing as he commands. He's the promised one. And then Onion Knight gets all passive-aggressive. He goes, well, I thought that was Stannis. And she just walks off, which I thought was really cool. And then we have this dinner scene where it's a big scene. We got Davos. Oh, no, this is outside. No, I'm sorry, I'm missing my notes. He follows a Red Woman downstairs. And now he wants to know what happened to Stannis. I guess it makes sense, though, because he's been dealing with Jon Snow and all those boneheaded Night's Watch guys. But he's like, what happened? And then Brienne kind of just butts right in. And she drops this, quoting my notes, blood magic bomb. And then I put forget her. Let me see. Forget her. Forgive. Oh, forget her. Forgive. Let me look here. Oh, because she says, oh, the devil says, I've never met. And she goes, well, yeah, I kind of met you because I was with Renly when all that stuff went down. Because she goes, you know, that I put in, you know, no kids listen, turn down the volume for a count to 50. Or if you're, you know, she stuns the fuck out of them, which she does. I put Ada, stuns the fuck out of OTTA them. Because she does. She says, I don't forget and I don't forgive, you know, with this blood magic action. And she goes, yeah, so I thought about that when I took Stannis out, by the way. So good luck with that. And then we have old Sickly, the worst of the worst. This kid almost makes Joff likable, this kid. And then the Mockingbird Express shows up, which I guess I was pleased at the time, but it's true. But then there's this unbelievable... So there's this, I put 3 stars and then more swearing. I guess turn down the volume again, please. If you don't like swearing. Yeah, because it was so fucking good. His fucking, so the door opens on the stagecoach. You got to rewatch the scene. It's at 12:30. His fucking legs are crossed. It's just so sweet. You just see his knees. This is so brilliant. Oh my gosh. And you just see his knees, like he's kicked back in his stagecoach, or it's just, oh my goodness. He's just kicked in there with his legs crossed. And I put, there's more swearing still to come. Fucking legs crossed, sly kickback motherfucker, because that's what it is. He's just kicking back. Oh man. I mean, whoever, oh my goodness, this is just the quality of the show.
And he rolls in, Peter Baelish. He says, the defender of the veil to the sickly kid, whatever his name is. And then he gives him this falcon, a gyroscopic falcon or something, rarest and greatest. And there's hugs and, I put G Falcon on my notes. And he has a showdown with Lord Royce, who's got a little bit too much equipment on. Lord Royce has got like a breastplate and a cloak on. And he stands next to Littlefinger as Robin Aaron plays with the bird and Littlefinger works his magic. Because Lord Royce is like, I thought you were going to do something. And he goes, well, I don't do things directly, bro. I do what's best. And Lord Royce says, do you take me for a fool? And he goes, you're a leaker, man. I know you're leaking out the info. And then Royce says, are you slandering me? And I tell you one pro tip, pro am tip here. Anybody uses the word slander, like in casual conversation, don't trust them ever again. Simple thing. I mean, if they're using it in context, but if they say slander in themselves, just walk away. I hate to break up families, but just do it. Trust me on this one. I mean, make sure to put it in context. You know, if they're at work or they're journalists and they're talking about, but if they use casual conversation, they drop slander within themselves. I mean, I'm sure there's like a cool way to say, you know, like, slander, like if they're using it in less than casual conversation, what's that called? Anyway, maybe don't listen to me. Actually, there you go. Pro-am tip, don't listen to Scoots. But probably avoid people that use slander, too. But yeah, he says, hey, sickly kid, what do we think we should do with this guy, Robin Aaron? And he says, let's get rid of him. And then Peter Baelish says, well, you know, I think if we could trust him totally, he might be a capable commander in the wars to come. So we get this wars to come callback again. And then Baelish is doing some bad acting, which I liked. And then at the end, he does this like smooth turn. And he goes, our Lord has spoken, because he says, let's send out the soldiers, you know. Because he says, let's go get, you know, let's take our, we got to go save Sansa, your cousin. And that's when he's kind of doing this bad acting to get Robin Aaron. He's pulling the strings, but he gets Robin Aaron to make a move. But he just does this cool, smooth turn. I don't know, again, I'm behind the episode. But, you know, somewhere around 15 minutes, that happens. Let's see what else. Our Lord has spoken. Time has come to join the fray. I really like that line. Then we see a harpy boat. And then we have Tyrion dropping some privilege on Grey Worm and Missandei. Not his finest moment, you know. Because Grey Worm and Missandei are like, why would you work with slavers? You know, why are you going to negotiate with them in diplomacy? And Tyrion's kind of this whole theme of like, which is worse, war or slavery, you know? And Missandei says, how long, because Tyrion says, well, I can identify. And she says, well, how long were you a slave? He goes, long enough to know. And she says, not long enough to understand. So such, such well-handled, discourse. Let's just say, let's leave it at that. Beautifully, beautifully handled discourse. I think that you could take more meaning from. And after she says that, Varys gives a nice look, funny little look, like, well, she's right, or something to Tyrion. And we also get like a view a few times here in Marine of the budget that must have even gone up again. So there's these outside sets, and I don't know if they're digital or painted or a combination of real location, but just beautiful locations
with either pure location or set design on some level. Just gorgeous, gorgeous. And then we have the Slaver Centurion. He's kind of talking about reversal of fortune. He's got like this line, friends, friends, friends. Because they're trying to say, you know, these guys, you know, it's just like a back and forth kind of carryover from the scene. Should we negotiate? Should we give to them? And if you watch the extras at the end, they kind of Weiss and Benioff talk about it, kind of the influences. He also impressed him when he says, you know, Jesus, Westeros doesn't have any slaves, and I'm richer than all of you put together. So he said, you know, he says, Jesus, then they make a negotiation. He says, let us sail on the tide of freedom instead of being drowned by it. And then he kind of, and I think there's an extra layer here. Nothing is ever as it seems. Where you say, geez, you really sold out your people, your main peeps, Missandei and Grey Worm. Let's see, those get rich, slavers kind of seem surprised and impressed. 7 years of more of slavery. Grey Worm and Missandei were not pleased, shocked, torn. Then Tyrion goes into the temple to deal with the people who are like, dude, what the heck is going on? And they have to eat crow for peace. And Missandei and Grey Worm kind of have to, oh, they have to eat crow. So they have to say, oh, well, you know, this is a good idea, I guess. But when they get outside and they're alone, Grey Worm's pissed. He's like, dude, you can't trust these guys and you're selling out. Like ethics and morals, I think. And I guess Tyrion would quote Lincoln, you know, geez, I don't know what to do here. I'm trying to make the best decision I can. Which maybe he says that. Again, we get more another shot of these sets and location shots, which are gorgeous. And more talk about trust and slavery and war and contempt and being used. It really comes down to is who's using who or whom. And, you know, that is kind of wrong, you know. Then we're back in these Badlands and we have Dario who's kind of talking crass about the Khaleesi. It's kind of humorous, but you should see it for yourself and decide what you think. But this is, you know, some humorous relief because they're talking about Dario's kind of talking to Tyrion, he's out of breath. He can barely climb the hills they're climbing. And he's using that to say, hey, you couldn't be with the Khaleesi anyway. He's kind of so humble. It's a humble brag for sure. And then he says, well, it just must make you angry. The queen chose me. And Jorah says, it makes me sad. You're going to disappoint her anyway. And then she'll move on. Or maybe he says, well, we'll disappoint her. We'll all disappoint her before long. And then Jorah's like, well, I've had enough of your mouth. And he's like, well, what are you going to do? I'm not going to do anything. And Sir Jorah says, you didn't get much discipline as a child, did you? And he's like, nope. Then they have to get rid of their weapons because you're not allowed weapons. Of course, Dario doesn't listen to that, but Dario also sees Jorah's secret that he's sick with the stone disease. But they also do a little bit of a tiny piece of exposition, I guess, that says, to reassure us, he's like, well, it's only in contact, skin-to-skin contact, that it's communicable. So it's like, oh, okay, that's a good piece of information to remind us of, especially me, because I had forgotten that. I still can't forgive Jorah, because it's like, well, what if the Khaleesi tripped and bumped into you, you know? So, I mean, I guess I'd have to rewatch all the tape to see if he was standing, like, at a 6 feet distance from her. But again, she could do a double trip, like trips, then stumbles, because I do that all the time, those kind of trips. So even then, 10 feet's not enough, you know. But then it's night, and they sneak into the giant Dosh Galeen? No, that's the Dothra. I don't know. They sneak in there. and there's wild parties going on, and what's-his-name says, hey, I should have been born a Dothraki. Then they get busted. Then we have the Khaleesi with the Dosh Kaleen. One other piece of exposition I missed is that they say there's 100,000 Khal people down there, or Dothraki people, so that is important to know, too. So then we have, let's see. Okay, so we have the Khaleesi with the Dosh Kaleen, and the main lady's like talking, oh, some of these are not that smart, and they don't realize that I'm culturally, and then she introduces Khaleesi to one of her young proteges, and Khaleesi shows her some interest and compassion. Like, kind of, what was your story, huh? And it's a story that the Khaleesi can relate to, so it kind of pulls in her heartstrings. And then the Dosh Kaleen kind of talks about how they play a second fiddle to the patriarchy, and you'll have to see what the patriarchs decide to do with you, because you don't have a choice. And the Khaleesi says, I think they had one other line. Oh, she says, well, geez, you can't run. And Khaleesi says, I'll never run. That's not what I do. And then she says, I got to go make water. Oh, the other line was the older woman said, well, our lives have meaning. And Khaleesi said, well, that's most, but she was saying, like, even within the patriarchy. And I guess Khaleesi was kind of seeing this as a gray area, too. She's like, well, that's more than a lot of people have, but it's still not good enough for our Khaleesi. It is known. She went, she's going for empowerment. So then she rolls out with her new friend and says, man, those old women stink, and, I need fresh air because they're getting on my nerves. And then she kind of creates some rapport, a real rapport. I always hate how that word is, but she really creates a connection with this other young woman. So that then they run into Jorah and whatever that Dario, and she says, oh, no, this girl's my friend. I can trust her, this young woman. And the woman says, Khaleesi says, can I? And she says, yeah, you can. Then we see Marjorie the next scene. Oh, wait, there's more dialogue. I put Khaleesi lays on the charm. I don't know. I don't think the dialogue was that with Jorah and Dario's that important. But then we have Marjorie in her cell. She's taken out and she goes to see the sparrow. And when she first comes into the room, he's in his the place he likes to hang, the grotto, Sparrow's Grotto. And when she first goes in, like, the light is too bright, so she shields her eyes and her shoulders are stooped and her eyes are on the floor. And I kind of was wondering, on the second rewatch, is she acting almost? It's so good how kind of thing. And then we have this discussion with Sparrow. He says, hey, if I let you out, where would you go? And she goes, to see my brother or my husband or my family. And he goes, well, that's sin, money and power. And he says, well, I'm not maligning you. He goes, I did that too, to the exclusion of all else. And he tells this parable about being a cobbler. And his father was a simple man, simple shoes, but then the sparrow was an artisanal craftsman of shoes, and he made expensive shoes. A dozen of hours on a single pair. Quality takes time. Marjorie says, yeah, I bet you've worn a year of someone's time on your back. And he goes, yeah, but the rich people, they paid well for my shoes, so I could get, middle class existence. And he goes, I would indulge, and I felt myself ascending to something better. And Price is at his best. This is a really good scene with Jonathan Price. And Natalie Dormer is just, wow. Especially when you get to watch it twice, because you get to see the full arc of this episode, and it's like... They say, goodbye, Cersei. Hello, Marjorie. I mean, maybe, I don't know. She might be, she might be too healthy for me. But she it's just a, I don't know. But he goes on with this scene. Yeah, you know, I used to, so I ascended to, I find myself trying to ascend to something better. And then Marjorie kind of turns it on her. She goes, and one day you walked through a graveyard, realizing it was all for nothing, and set out on the path of righteousness. Book of the Stranger, verse 25. And the Spirit says, oh, you know the seven-pointed star. She goes, yeah, that crazy woman reads it to me nonstop. And he goes, oh, yes, yes. Oh, she goes, reads it to me nonstop. And she goes, at me. And he goes, oh, yeah, she does enjoy reading at people. He goes, you're close. It wasn't a graveyard. It was a feast. You know, we were up to no good. And I was on a serious bender. And he goes, I woke up before dawn, totally rock bottom. I mean, I guess I can relate some sense. Because he says he even had, and wow, I didn't realize how deep this went. But he goes, yeah, the next morning, all the smells and everything. I realized it was the morning after I saw with perfect clarity that all the wine, women, and gold, and my ceaseless struggle to maintain my position was all part of a story. A story I was telling myself about who I was, a collection of lies that would disappear in the light. The people I was trying to climb away from, my people, the poor, were closer to the truth than I was. So then Marge said, what did you do? And now she's kind of engaged. He goes, well, I went out and tried to find them. I didn't even put on my shoes. I just headed out. Let's see what else. Shoulder stoop, parable. Marjorie's kind of on the ground while he's telling the story. Her arms are crossed. To me, when he says to me, she rolls her eyes up. This was when she said, oh, she read this seven-point star to me, at me. She rolls her eyes up to the left. I really liked that. The acting was amazing. When he says, there's this, so when he starts the end of his parable about his moment of clarity, he's framed and the camera really slow pulls in. He's looking off to the right, like somewhere, like he's looking way into the past, which he is. So such a good scene. And then Marjorie goes to Loris. He says, hey, let's go see your brother. But and again, I guess the brilliance of that scene. And the nice thing about this next scene is it reminds us that Jesus is, I mean, being misdirected, but I don't know how the magic works, right? So it's like Weiss, Benioff, and Martin and the entire cast and crew of Game of Thrones here have us in their thrall, or at least me. So I say, well, there's this sparrow. Some of his words are saying things I can understand and even relate to, but his actions, aren't his actions kind of atrocious? And then where's Marjorie on all this? And then so she goes to her brother, Loris. And he kind of seems like his spirit's broken. And she says, you need to stay strong. And he's like, I can't. I never was strong. She goes, you're strong, man. You're the future of our family. He goes, I don't care. And she goes, well, you know, come on. We got to act like we're talking about something else. Don't tell them you're broken. And he goes, I just want to get out. And she goes, this is a game. That's why they're having me talk to you, to kind of wear you down. That's why I'm here. She goes, I know this guy. You know, she's saying that she thinks she knows how the magic trick works, but it's like within the magic trick. That's how great it is. Like the rabbit or the kid, whatever. I'm like, what? And she's like, we can't give in. Just make it stop. We can't let them win. And Loris is kind of, he's broken though. But Marjorie's, you know, holding him and loving him. And it also reminded me, he says, help me. And it reminded me of Tommen and Cersei. And also, I put Marjorie's just so hard. She's such a badass. I love her. I mean, let's not get into my feelings about Marjorie. But
She's a fictional character. I got to remind myself then. But I liked how it echoed the moment with Tommen and Cersei from either episode 2 or 3. Now I can't remember. To which we have, like, Cersei's in the hall in this nice black gown, black and gold. Blubbering Maester's talking to Tommen about a bunch of garbage about how to kind of give in to the High Sparrow, not to challenge him. Okay, so the Tommen's talking to Blubbering Maester, and he's like, yeah, just back down. You don't want to do anything. You don't want to upset this guy. And Cersei rolls in, and Tommen tries to sort of, he's standing by the window. Cersei closes the door after she kicks him out. I liked that. And Tommen looks at the window, and he's talking to Cersei. He's trying to be assertive, but he's kind of holding his hands uncomfortably. And he says, let's not antagonize this guy. He's got Marjorie. I don't want to risk her. This guy's dangerous. And Cersei's like, Marjorie? She didn't say that, but she says, well, you know what they did to the king's mother? And he goes, well, that's the past, Mom. I'm more worried about Marjorie, you know, my wife, the one I, you know, get to kiss and stuff, like you. But you're also evil and manipulative, as much as I love you. And he goes, let me ask you something. Do you like Marjorie? And she goes, well, that's not important at all. She's the queen. I mean, that must have taken everything she had just to say that. And she goes, queens must command respect. Kings even more so. And I guess you can savor this if you watch it 2 or 3 times. This is not just for their sake, for everyone's. The High Sparrow doesn't have respect. No respect for anything in this world. No use for things of this world. He just wants to take things out and replace them with fantasies. With beggars in the street, with nothing. And he goes, well, Mother, I got a secret to have with the High Sparrow. And she goes, you met with the Sparrow? He goes, well, I promised I wouldn't tell anyone. And she goes, I am your mother. You can always trust me. And then the scene cuts, which is wild. Because it's like, what was said? And then the small council meeting's going on with Blubbering Maester talking to Lady Tyrell, Olyanna, and Sir Kevin. And it's just Cersei and Jaime. Like, oh, this meeting's over. And at first, they're greeted with the venom. Let me check these notes. Oh, Tommen's mouth was open as she said, "You can trust me." Okay, Cersei and Jaime, they lay in the plan, and there's a nice light strings of Reigns of Castamere. Because first they insult them, and then Jaime's like, you know, Cersei's the mother of the king. You know, because Olyanna's like, you have no authority here. The king, you know, king trusts us, not you two boneheads. And she goes, you know, the king's talking to the High Sparrow, and, you know, the High Sparrow wants us to fight. Jaime and Cersei, it really looks like they play these two, so I'm curious to see what happens. And they say, well, now the future of the Seven Kingdoms is in his dirty peasant hands. You know, they're going to have a trial. They're going to make Marjorie atone, walk through the city. Olenna's like, no, that's not going to happen. Cersei's like, oh, of course. I agree with you totally. Why don't you call your army, the second largest in Westeros, and have them deal with the High Sparrow. Then we're not breaking Tommen's trust, because he said don't do anything. That's what Kevin says. We're not supposed to do anything, according to the king. And he just says, well, the Tyrell armies are going to do stuff, not you, so you just stand down. And Sir Kevin's like, didn't this happen in season 1? Cersei, didn't you do so? Was that season 2? And she goes, what about your son? Don't you care about your son who's in this throes of this religious thing? And then everyone says, oh boy, I guess we're on board here. Strange bedfellows. But then they say, well, we're all rich. Who cares? You know, because they say, well, it's war. You know, isn't the other theme going over there? Not war. what's it good for? And they're saying, well, not for poor people, absolutely not for war. Good gosh, y'all. What is it good for? Not bad for the rich. What's it good for poor people? Absolutely not good. Or something like that it goes. And as the scene rolls on, the who was playing who? It was too easy, it seemed like, but the strings kept getting louder and louder, which was nice. Then we have Rika in a ship looking longingly at the Iron Islands, then looking afraid, then he looks down. Then his sister's sitting in a chair by a fire. She's kind of in a bad mood. She's like, well, what do you let you go? He goes, I escaped. She goes, I can't hear you. He goes, I escaped. You know, and she's really mad. He's like, well, I was broken. And she, well, I don't care. She goes, I want to be in charge here. And now you're coming back in here. He goes, well, I don't want to be in charge. He goes, I want you to be in charge. And he said, wait a second, don't you guys know about that scene? I said, maybe they don't. Seen a chair, escaped Ramsey. Oh, then we have Ramsey and Rickon's caretaker, whose name escapes me at the moment. And then we have this Castle Black, and a message comes in, and this is the dinner scene that everybody's talking about here. We have dinner, we have Brienne looking around, we have Tormund consuming pig's feet with glee in silence, while staring at Brienne. And you got Ned kind of looking on in confusion. And then someone rolls in. They're like, sorry about this food. And Sansa's like, you know, I know how to be polite. It's fine. And I'm just going to rewatch it here. This will be an experiment. Occasionally we could do this. So they have the messenger coming in with a white flag into Castle Black. Nice little shot through the gates. Gates are closing. Fork with pig's foot. Or maybe it looks like a spare rib, actually. Sansa eating, John eating, John's kind of looking, Bran's looking around now, looking at her food, not eating, looking over at Tormund, who's making food love to his meat, really, and Bran looks down after a while. She's still in chainmail. Tormund looks pretty pleased. Ned looks confused, raises his eyebrows. I've seen that gif a few times, or chif. And that's when, then the letter comes in. And they read the letter. It's from Ramsay. It says, hey, I'm going to come, you know, you come here, I'll come there. But I'm up to no good. I'm Ramsay. You know, I got Rickon. Sansa's like, he must have taken his dad out. Now he's in charge. He's making threats. And he has Rickon, so we have to do. And then they're like, well, how many men does he have? They said about 5,000, I think. And then John's like, well, Tormund, how many we got? And he says, like, 2,000, barely. And then Sansa's like, John, you're the warden of the last son of the warden of the North. People are loyal. Really, really loyal? Oh, boy. You know, you just have to ask for help. He goes, this guy's, you know, taking our home and our brother. We have to go back to Winterfell and save them both. And then she reaches out for his hand and he nods. And then we have this scene with the Khals, and they're talking about, you know, geez, what's going on here? And then they say, bring in the Khaleesi. And they say, hey, we're just trying to figure out, you know, they say, leave us. And they say, well, who cares what she wants? You know, who is this? And they're kind of talking about her and kind of making fun of her. And this is one of the great scenes. They say, well, maybe we'll keep her with the Dash Kaleen. But then they say the masters of Yukai are offering 10,000 horses for her. And they go, isn't she worth, let's give her 10,000 horses. And he goes, well, I don't like the wise masters of Yun Kai. We'll take the horses. Khaleesi says, don't you care what I think? And they're like, no, what are you kidding us? And she goes, no, I don't care. And they say, well, we don't care. I go, this is a, you don't have any voice. This is a patriarchy. And he goes, they go, we decide. And then Khaleesi says, you know, I've been here before. I know where I am. This is where the Dash Kaleen, you know, they, I had this dream or something, the sorceress. And they're like, yeah, you're a sucker for sorcery. It's all your fault. All the bad luck that befell Khal Drogo. And she goes, well, Drogo made me a promise that the Dothraki people would help me reclaim the throne. Take out the Iron Stones. She's working the room. She's walking around. Then she walks up on these pedestals or on stage. And she goes, what are these great calls discussing? What little villages you'll raid? How many girls you're going to take as tribute? She goes, you're small men. None of you are fit to lead the Dothraki. But I am. And then she says, so I will. And she has this look on her face. And these guys aren't taking her seriously. But she's got this cool, confident, defiant look on her face. Almost amused at that she knows she's the one in the power and they're powerless. Let me see. Walks around, takes the stage. You're small men, but I am, so I will. She stares, she smiles as they talk and get mad. And they say, oh, geez, whatever. And they say, do you think we're going to serve us? And she goes, they say, do you think you're really going to serve us? And she goes, you're not going to go serve anybody. You're out. And then she says, you're out, boys. And she says, I'm the phoenix. It is known that Khaleesi is a phoenix. And she's just so cool in that scene. And then the doors fall off the building. The Khaleesi emerges like a naked phoenix I put there. And everyone falls to their knees. There's like this drumming, chanting music. And even Jorah the Andal and what's his name? I guess because I'm jealous of him too. Whatever his name is, Dario Naharis. They even work their way up, but then they even fall to their knees. And she stares down from a B word. I don't know what that word is, but she has this like proud, like almost like a, like the head of the pride look, like more than a lioness, even greater than a lioness, so much more. But just this proud look, stares down. I don't know what that word is. But everyone is like, okay, this it is known now. I mean, I guess the building's behind her. Maybe that's what I put. But it is a great scene, great music. In a great episode, so we'll see what happens next week, huh? But let's we'll look up some stuff. All right, everybody, we're talking about the Book of the Stranger here, and what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about the Stranger on a bunch of different levels and Strange a little bit. I mean, I guess this will be kind of a monoculture episode. It'll all be about strangers and some strange. You know what I mean. Because sometimes, you know, when the Game of Thrones gives, sometimes it gives in abundance. And tonight was no. So this is where it took me. So we're going to open up with a little bit and then we'll talk about, you know, just roll with it. How about that? We're going to start with like some prose from a song. Well, we all have a face that we hide away forever. And we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk, some are leather. They're the faces of a stranger, but we love to try them on. Well, we all fall in love, but we disregard the danger. Though we share so many secrets, there's some we never tell. Why were you surprised that you never saw the stranger? Did you ever let your lover see the stranger in yourself? Don't be afraid to try again. Everyone goes south now and then. You've done it. Why can't someone else? You should know by now. You've been there yourself. Once I used to believe I was such a great romancer. Then I came home to a woman that I could not recognize. When I pressed her for a reason, she refused to even answer. It was then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes. Well, we all fall in love, but we disregard the danger. Though we share so many secrets, there are some we never tell. Why were you so surprised that you never saw the stranger? Did you ever let your lover see the stranger in yourself? Don't be afraid to try again. Everyone goes south now and then. You've done it. Why can't someone else? You should know by now. You've been there yourself. You may never understand how the stranger is inspired, but he isn't always evil. And he is not always wrong. Though you drown in good intentions, you will never quench the fire. You'll give in to your desire when the stranger comes along. And that was written by Billy Joel from the song The Stranger. But let's bounce over the Game of Thrones wiki to find out about the stranger. Catelyn Stark is quoted at the top of the wiki. Finally, there is the stranger, rarely prayed to, who represents passing. The stranger's aspect of the seven represents death and the unknown, rarely prayed to. Unlike the other aspects which are represented in human figures in artwork, the stranger represents the unknown, so it can be portrayed in a wide variety of forms. You know, sometimes in a wide variety of archetypal things, I'll say. And that's it, I guess, from the wiki. There's more about the books, and it comes up in this episode, as we talked about. And I just think it's like a great example of such a term. I mean, that George R. Martin picked the term the stranger is just brilliant because it has such meaning for us in this modern day. But we really can't have a conversation about the stranger without talking about the novel by Camus, which my dyslexia, it makes me really hard to pronounce. Until somebody told me how to pronounce it, I did not know how to pronounce it. Albert Camus, 1942. And this book had a great recent impact on me in the last 5 years. But just reading from Wikipedia, The Stranger or The Outsider, in French, La Tranger. Its theme and outlook are often cited as examples of Camus' philosophy of absurd and existentialism, though it says Camus rejected the latter label. The protagonist is Meursault, I think is how you pronounce it, and they say is an indifferent French Algerian. Well, actually, we don't need to cover the plot too much. In January 1955, Camus wrote, I summarized The Stranger a long time ago with a remark I admit was highly paradoxical. In our society, any man who does not weep at his mother's funeral runs the risk of being sentenced to trouble. I only meant that the hero of my book is condemned because he does not play the game. And there's a big write-up on the plot and stuff. Reception, The Stranger's first edition consisted of 4,400 copies, and it couldn't become a bestseller. But it was well-received due to Jean-Paul Sartre's article on the eve of publication. Vigiani wrote of the book, Carl Vigiani wrote of the book, On the Surface, La Tranger gives the appearance of being an extremely simple, though carefully planned and written book. In reality, it is a dense and rich creation full of undiscovered meanings and formal qualities. It would take a book at least the length of the novel to make a complete analysis of the meaning and form of correspondences in the book. So there's a lot about it. There's so much stuff, and it's been appeared in so many different things. I think I've kind of talked about how it came up for me.
But maybe there's a New Yorker article. I just want to cite a couple of things from that. Maybe I'll read a little bit from the book and maybe talk about it. But there's this New Yorker article by Ryan Bloom from May 11, 2012. Lost in translation, what the first line of The Stranger should be. It's interesting because they talk about how the opening sentence in the original translation was Mother Died Today. That was a Gilbert translation from 46. And then there was two translations in 82 who kept that Mother Died Today. And then in 88, there was a poet, Matthew Ward, who reverted Mother to the original text, which was Maman. It's just an interesting article talking about Jesus. Is that too formal, Mother Died Today? Did that influence how we read the book? Is Maman too French, or too, is it inaccessible, or is it just the right word? And then he kind of talks about, geez, you're supposed to read this in high school, which I didn't. I didn't read it till I was like 38 years old, probably. Maybe in my late 30s. And it's a good read, this article. And then he talks about kind of, well, what if you change it to today Mother has died instead of Mother died today, which is smoother, more natural rendering. But if you change that, is that changing the meaning? Rendering the line as Mother Died Today completely neglects the specific ordering of ideas that offer insight into Marsalt's inner psyche. And this is the part I wanted to quote here. Throughout the course of the novel, the reader comes to see Marsalt as a character who first and foremost lives for the moment. He does not consciously dwell on the past, nor does he worry about the future. What matters is today. The single most important factor of his being is right now. And then it kind of goes in, not far behind, though, is Maman. Marcel shares a unique relationship with his mother. And it's just an interesting way of looking at translation and things. This loss of Mother drives the action of the novel, leading inexorably to the end, the final period that hangs over all things else, passing. Early in the book, Camus links the death of Marsalt's mother with the oppressive, ever-present son. So then we get to the climax, we see the symbolism. Son equals loss of mother. Son causes Marsalt to do what he does. And in case we don't get it, Camus makes the connection explicit, saying, it was the same sun as the day I buried Maman. And then my forehead especially was hurting me, all of the veins pulsating together beneath the skin. And the final passage in this is, the ordering of the words in Camus' first sentence is no accident. Today is interrupted by Maman's death. The sentence, the one we have yet to see correctly rendered in an English translation of L'Étranger, should read, today, Maman died. And this is like one of my favorite passages here, and it kind of summarizes I love it when I read stuff that I can't ever possibly recreate in some way, and just as the richness of the imagery, and then as the New Yorker article said, the capturing of the moment here. At 5, there was a loud clanging of streetcars. They were coming from a stadium in our suburb where there had been a football match. Even the back platforms were crowded and people were standing on the steps. Then another streetcar brought back the teams. I knew they were the players by the little suitcase each man carried. They were bawling out their team song, "Keep the ball rolling, boys." One of them looked up to me and shouted, "We licked them." I waved my hand and yelled back, "Good work." From now on, there was a steady stream of private cars. The sky had changed again. A reddish glow was spreading up beyond the housetops. As dusk set in, the street grew more crowded. People were returning from their walks, and I noticed this dapper little man with the fat wife among the passers-by. Children were whimpering and trailing wearily after their parents. After some minutes, the local picture houses disgorged their audiences. I noticed that the young fellows coming from them were taking longer strides and gesturing more vigorously than at ordinary times. Doubtless the picture they had seen was of the Wild West variety. Those who had been to the picture houses in the middle of town came by a little later and looked more sedate, though a few were still laughing. On the whole, however, they seemed languid and exhausted. Some of them remained loitering in the street under my window. A group of girls came by, walking arm in arm. The young men under my window swerved so as to brush against them and shouted humorous remarks which made the girls turn their heads and giggle. I recognized them as girls from my part of the town, and two or three of them, whom I knew, looked up and waved to me. Just then, the street lights came on altogether, and they made the stars that were beginning to glimmer in the night sky paler still. I felt my eyes getting tired, what with the lights and all the movement I'd been watching in the streets. There were little pools of brightness under the lamps, and now and then a streetcar passed, lighting up a girl's hair, or a smile, or a silver bangle. Soon after this, the streetcars became fewer, and the sky showed velvety black above the trees and the lamps. The street grew emptier, almost imperceptibly, until a time came when there was nobody to be seen, and a cat, the first of the evening, crossed, unhurrying, the deserted street. And I really love this short passage of dialogue where they're talking about marriage. Marie and Mersaldi said they're going back and forth. Yeah, because she says, "Geez, what do you think about getting married?" And he's kind of detached. Then she said she wondered if she really loved me or not. I, of course, couldn't enlighten her as to that. And after another silence, she murmured something about me being a queer fellow. "And I dare say that's why I love you," she added. "But maybe that's one day. But maybe that's why one day I'll come to hate you." To which I had nothing to say, so I said nothing. And that's why I love that book. But it also stresses me out. I don't know, something about my connection to the character's detachment and the richness of the imagery and the way things turn against, like the way he kind of falls into the river of his fate or something. I don't know. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm not a literary critic, so I don't quite have the terminology to describe my experience when reading the book. But it's just whoa. And I guess because I don't like the very little internal life Mersault seems to have. Like he lives externally and through things where I kind of have so much going on. But then as I recognize his bad choices and the inevitability of them, and then things coming full circle on him, I don't know. I must have read the book four times right in a row. And the copy I have is a Stuart Gilbert Vintage Books edition from, it's pretty old. I think it's my dad's book from high school. 1946 edition. It still costs $1.25. It's a paperback. Okay, but if that's the book, The Stranger, we opened with the passages from the song The Stranger, which is on the fifth studio album, according to Wikipedia, by Billy Joel, who came out in 77. And this was his first critical and commercial breakthrough, spending 6 weeks at number two. And in 76, Joel had a reliable touring band with Doug Stegmeier on bass, Liberty DeVito on drums, and Richie Cannata on sax, flute, clarinet, and organ. And Joel had written a bunch of new songs and wanted to use his touring band in the studio. As he had done on Turnstiles, he met with George Martin, the producer for the Beatles, who he wanted him to produce, but Martin kind of showed interest but didn't want to use Joel's band, So Joel met with a veteran New York City producer, Phil Ramone, and they got along great. They said it was a blast recording the album, and it contains 9 songs, one of which is The Stranger. And there's also an untitled 2-minute instrumental hidden track, which is a reprise of The Strong. Originally, Billy Joel wanted the melody to be played by some sort of instrument, but after Joel demonstrated the melody by whistling it, Phil Ramone convinced him to whistle instead, which was a big part of the song. And I guess there's not too much written about the song itself, other than the lyrics. It's a little bit more about the masks we wear than the... it's not really about the book, The Stranger. But, you know, it has The Stranger in it. And then, you know, if truth couldn't be stranger than fiction, we have ourselves a three-eyed raven, Max von Sydow. And we have a book, and then we have a movie that as a kid I think we had on VHS or something. So I saw it about 1,000 times called Strange Brew. So it has a connection to the show. It was a 1983 Canadian comedy. Strange Brew, also known as The Adventures of Bob and Doug McKenzie, Strange Brew. And it featured the popular Second City television characters, Bob and Doug McKenzie, played by Dave Thomas, and our beloved Rick Moranis. We love Dave Thomas too, but beloved Rick Moranis, who also served as co-directors. Co-stars included Max von Sydow, Paul Dooley, Lynn Griffith, and Angus McGuinness, loosely based on elements of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Most of the film was shot in Southern Ontario, Toronto, Scarborough, Kitchener, and Hamilton. The plot of the movie, if you don't see it, is two unemployed brothers, Bob and Doug McKenzie, place a mouse in a beer bottle in an attempt to blackmail the local beer store into giving them free beer, and are told to take up the matter at the Elsinore Brewery instead. After presenting the mouse to the management, they are given jobs inspecting the bottles for mice on the bottling line at the plant. But we soon learn that the evil brewmeister Smith, played by Max von Sydow, is perfecting a secret plan to take over the world by placing a mind-controlled drug in Elsinore beer, which, you know, controls the minds of the people that drink it when they hear certain musical tones. And they're also testing it out on, a mental health facility that's nearby. And they find out about it. And they're investigating a slapstick comedy. It's like, you know, a kid's dream come true. It's got all the elements. Some stuff about production. In 81, Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, they had a big comedy album, The Great White North, sold 1 million copies. And they wanted to parlay that into movies because John Candy had just had a big movie. And then they kind of had some trouble with some old contracts, and they were trying to figure out how to make the movie. They hired Steve DeJarnett, according to Wikipedia, to do the first draft, who said they wanted to base the movie on Hamlet, but it was too close to Hamlet, and he needed to be more creative. Moranis and Thomas's agent sent the script to a bunch of studios, and then they made a deal with MGM, based not on the script, but on the record sales. The breakout, the potential, and the fact that it was being advertised on a television show. But they were unhappy with the script because Bob and Doug are improvised characters done in comic voices. And they felt that nobody but themselves could write for these characters. So Thomas began rewriting the script without Moranis, who was now uncertain about doing the film. After Thomas got the first 50 pages done, Moranis took a look at it, and then they started rewriting it. However, they weren't sure how much they could get done, how much they could legally change, but they did a bunch of changes, including like adding another movie to it that Bob and Doug were making. Thomas remembers that the script was far more bizarre and conceptual in the beginning. Sounds like this podcast. If we had been able to rewrite the whole thing, we could have made the whole thing like that. Originally, Moranis and Thomas were not going to direct, but they ended up doing so with the guidance of Jack Grossberg, who had produced Mel Brooks and Woody Allen movies, with a budget of $5 million. Before filming, all the major breweries wanted the McKenzie brothers in beer advertisements, but they got Molson Brewery. But once they found out there was a joke about a mouse in a beer bottle, and that they were using it to get free beer, no brewers wanted to do it. They couldn't even go do it in a film in a beer store. So they had to use a Tim Hortons to film it. And then they ended up having to do a beer store and spend a bunch of money to make a fake beer store. Strange Brew currently holds a 71% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, with 81% from users. Interview in the New York Times, Janet Maslin wrote, "Anyone who's partial to McKenzie's humor doubtless has a fondness for beer. Maybe save, this is paraphrasing, but save your money, spend it on beer." Gary Arnold, in his review for Washington Post, "Neither triumph nor fiasco. Strange Brew leaves plenty of room for improvement." In the Globe and the Mail, Jay Scott wrote, "What's terrific about the McKenzie brothers is their offhand depiction of two English-Canadian working-class dimlets. What's terrific about the movie is its equally offhand surrealism." And yeah, I mean, as a kid, I haven't seen this movie, so I don't know if it holds up, but I remember loving it as a kid. A sequel to the film, Homebrew, was planned for production in 1999, though financing fell through. It was written by Dave Thomas and Paul Flaherty. Flaherty was going to direct, Dan Aykroyd was on board, and they were just about to start filming in July of 1999 in Toronto when the financing didn't work out. So that's too bad. But yeah, Strange Brew, you could check it out. And then in all the small world irony, this article just came out May 18th, 2016, literally just came out. Winona Ryder has a Netflix series called Stranger Things, believe it or not. She's going to appear in a part of this Netflix show, Stranger Things, which is being described as a love letter to the ubiquitous cult classics of the 80s. It's presumably a reference to films like The Lost Boys rather than Fast Times or Ferris Bueller's, and not some combination of them. At least that's the impression they got, because it's got some more adult content. But well, Ryder uses a rotary phone. It might be a spooky mystery that's at the heart of the show. Ryder plays a mother. The Equalizer's David Harbour as a police chief. When the series was announced last summer, Matthew Modine isn't pictured, nor is his role described in the synopsis below. But he's supposed to be in it. It hits July 15th, so a couple more weeks. Set in Hawkins, Indiana in 1980s, Stranger Things chronicles some mysteries, unraveling of them of a top secret government stuff, kind of X-Files, a love letter to the ubiquitous cult classics of the 80s, a coming-of-age story for three boys that draws this quaint community into a world where mysteries lurk beneath the surface. So, how about that, you know? It kind of sounds a little bit like Goonies, too. All right, so that's it for Stranger Stuff this week. Are you ready, Simon?
I'm ready, Podman. This is improving this adventure.
All right, so let's just go straight into... You're not going to criticize...
I'm critical, but I'm not criticizing.
Oh, wow. So, even internally?
Hey, let us move forward with the show, Podman.
Tommen, are you feeling all right?
Podman, I've never felt more not all right or not bad at the same time. Right, Sir Pounce?
Hey, man, Sir Man.
Yes, I am neither plus nor minus man.
Okay, let's do this. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another K-Pounce Fun Time Hour, Adventure Time on K-Pounce, the radio station of best friendship, the radio station inspired by friendship, K-Pounce Radio. Okay, Podman. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Tom and Pounce on the road in the journey to Zelv Discovery. Deep within the forbidden jungles lies a great temple called Zelv Discovery. Within that temple, treasures innumerable to count. But thus far in all of human history, no one has been both brave enough and friendly enough and witty enough to discover the treasures within and beat all the tests. But two heroes have worked their way through the jungle and have entered the temple on their quest to go deep into Zelv-Discovery. Two best friends, two beacons of bravery, Sir Tommen and Sir Pounce. Join us, won't you, on another adventure of Tommen and Pounce in Zelv-Discovery.
Okay, Sir Pounce, so according to this map, we should go here. And we should just take this here. Now, don't step on those, right, Sir Pounce?
No, man. No, man.
Right, no. Yes, I don't know. Just those ones with the squiggly. See, this is what the map says. Squiggly, like a cat's tail. I guess that makes it easy. And then we just, oh, dear. What is this door is closing? And it's pushing against us. This is, remember when we went on that, that ride the Podman took us in, the innumerable doors. Mason, what is that called? The innumerable door. He was spinning those spinning doors. Oh, no, that was someone in a movie, but I thought it was me having joy in those doors. But, oh, boy, we're in another room now. And who is that at the back of the room there in some sort of ceremonial garb? Who are you, sir?
I am the keeper of abstraction, Tommen, and you are trapped within the halls of imagery of ununderstandability. Okay, well, I understand what you're saying, so that's already incorrect. I need to get through to the journey. I'm on a journey to Zelv's Discovery. Are there any treasures within these walls of innumerability or whatever you call them?
You cannot possibly escape. No one has. For I will use my abstractions to confuse and defeat you.
Okay, but why would you want to do that is my question, because I'm just here trying to get to the...
Like, do you just stay here all the time? We are here to protect the great treasure of Zelv-Discovery and test those... To see if the worthy ones will come, and they must pass our tests or be defeated, for only the worthy ones can discover.
Okay, okay, pull it together.
Only the worthy ones will discover Zelv-Discovery.
Okay, well, advance word might have gotten to you that I have the cat that put the braveness in bravery, so I no longer need to be afraid. So Pounce.
Round in town.
Yes, it, round in town is what he usually says, ambassador of abstraction. Please bring your test, for I was a boy, then I was a man, then I was a boy, you know, and then I was saying, mother, mother, but I'm no longer here to be irritated. I'm here to take on your challenge, so give it to me.
Well, this, Podman, this is working, this test, changing me.
Okay, we'll just focus because it's a recording. Oh, okay. Give me your abstraction. Whatever it is, I'll beat. It's no problem.
Well, I doubt you'll even be able to understand it.
Okay, what is that?
It is a wall of abstraction.
Oh, well, it's lowering in front of me. It's lowering in front of me. It seems to be some things written on it. Oh, what is that? A yellow circle.
a blue circle. It is, what am I supposed to do with this?
I guess you don't understand the meaning of challenge, do you?
I do, okay. Then there's a black rectangle. Yes, I know what a rectangle is, buffoon. And then a red rectangle. And a line going through it, I guess, Bounce. What do you think?
Mason, I mean.
Oh, yes, you're right. The line penetrates the black and red lines. I think we're supposed to figure out what this means. So a red rectangle or line, a black line, rectangle. Well, that's a rectangle, Sapounce, right?
Handsome man.
And both are faded. Now the line penetrates both the black and the red. It goes out the back of the red there, much like a, you know when those things they feed us, shababs, like the meat shababs. But as we go down, it looks like it was painted on old paper. And then there's a yellow circle. It's paler than a sun. It looks like an unhealthy sun. Oh, boy. Sapounce, you reading me? And then there's a small blue circle in front of it, obscuring a full of a blue, small blue moon. Like the moon, you know the moon, Sapounce. Okay, so an unhealthy sun. Oh, dear. A blue circle in front. Or is it a hole within the sun? It's off-center, Sapounce.
Yes, man.
Yes, the line is in front of it. The penetrating line does not penetrate the sun. But the line's above it. It's a bit of a stick.
Hey, Miss Anne.
It does not, circles do not end, you're right, Sapounce. Oh, but I see what you're saying. Each circle, the sun is just not one circle, but many circles expanding outward. Different shades of yellow, you're right, Sapounce. Interesting. Now, weeks ago, I would have just pressed at this and bumped against it, but I think this is the puzzle. This many-circled sun that does not look well. Is the key this blue thing within? Is it within the sun or without, Sapounce? That is the question. Is it a hole in the sun? Is it a moon within the sun? Or is it a moon in front of the sun? Is what we need to figure out. Is that right? This is supposed. Padman, that's a trick. I'm trying to trick the wizard to give me the answer. I did this once with the maester. Actually, Joff taught me this. Oh, you won't trick us, Sir Tommen, with your little games. You must determine it on your own. Okay, well, anyway, there was a test just to see, you know. I'm so brave now. Well, maybe so we don't know those answers, Sapounce. So why does the line, is that a tool that the sixth sun has used to spear the things that hang above it? One black, one red, and now Lannisters are red, Sapounce. You think, oh, and gold cloaks are. Oh, and gold is gold, you're right, but it's unhealthy, the color. I don't like this color, Sapounce.
Yes, I'm on.
Yes. So the sixth sun has a tool. What would the, I guess the black rectangle could be anything. Night, heavy things. Look at how the line, the tool line, the kebab line. See how it's different colors, Sapounce, if you study it there? Like somewhere, like it does look like wood almost, like it's a well-worn wood.
Amen.
So maybe the tool is holding those things up above his head, even though it would make sense with the balance. It could be, it's just a test, you know. And the sun does look like it's holding those things up. Or keeping things, he's holding so much up, this sick little sun. holding so much hangs above his head. Heavy. What was that bad man said? Heavy is the head. Oh, that's the crown, I believe. The red crown of the Lannisters. In a darker crown. That the sun has to hold just above his sick head. So there's, okay, Sir Pounce, you look at the look on the guy in the back. You're going to be opening this door soon. I'm one step away from solving this. Okay, so the sun, okay, so he's growing and expanding, but each expanding circle, he gets a little bit thinner. So he's the blue within. I say, could a son have a baby, Sir Pounce? You know, that looks like when they draw the pictures of the baby within. There's a baby blue within the sun. And I know, Sir Pounce, that's weird. I know, but it's true. Look at the painting. And yes, now I know this is a painting. I'm no fool. I'm surrounded by tapestries and paintings, you know. But what does it mean that the sun has a little blue? Oh, you're right, Sir Pounce. It's surrounded by a crescent of white. And the white seems to protect it. But it just does not look like it's integrating with the other sun. That's what troubles me, Sir Pounce. So that makes me think that it is a hole. That is, something is missing within the poor sick sun. Something blue has carved out its... Oh, goodness. Why did it take me so long, Sir Pounce? It's the blue-faced... It's the blue-faced man, of course. Oh. But who is larger? That is my question now to you, Sir Pounce. Who is growing and who is static? The sun is bigger, even though it has a blue hole from the blue-faced man. The sun is the one holding everything up. The sun is the one with circles going and expanding out. And the sun can handle the blue hole within it, probably, because he's doing the best he can to hold up all the weight above him, to keep on growing, even though with each stage of growth, part of him feels weaker, and he doesn't look as healthy as he should be. Even this powerful blue hole, so powerful in looks, even if it is within him, it cannot stop him from growing. And that is my answer for your test, Sir Wizard. Well, you have passed again, Sir Sam, and I will open the doors and you will pass on to the next phase on your journey to self-discovery. Your ability to deduce and infer is very impressive, and your ability to be outside of yourself and see yourself and discover. You defeated our most brilliant test thus far, and you have shown yourself worthy of both love and attention, affection and pride. You are truly worthy of going to the next test on the road to self-discovery. What an honor. Good day. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Batman. That was not bad. This is a puzzling picture. This is very good. I like this. I think I understand. That didn't feel very adventure-y, but it was hard. I enjoyed figuring this puzzle out. So, thank you. And you could close it out. So, Pounce and I are going to go. Wait a man. Yes, later, man. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that concludes another afternoon of Tom and Pounce on the Road to Self-Discovery. Thank you for joining us on K-Pounce Radio. Crone, Sweet Sweet Crone, Miller Smith, Barky, Jester, Hound. I think that's everybody. Crone, Sweet Sweet Crone, Miller Smith, Barky, Jester, Hound. Hopefully I'm not missing any gods. I did miss the casting list, though, and I know it's probably a waste of a prayer to go through our casting list, gods. Also, I didn't send out a memo because you never responded to any of my memos last season. So I said, why bother, you know? But I don't know, gods, just in case you didn't get the memo, me and the Jester, you know, mentally, I figure you could, if you can read minds, you know, I don't got to write a memo. It's already rotten. But I was thinking, like, so I talked to the, not the jester, who's that, Miller. Miller, I'm just kidding. And of course I know who you are. And I said, Gads, we need to get into, he said, we need to metaphorize this. And I was thinking, you might like the Goonies, and that would be a good way to help me. I forgot it. Well, I guess you will, you know, it'll help me without you doing any work. I figure, you know, I know how you like to work with, you know, like, I think, like, the metaphor you guys would use is a pebble, you know, pebble drops in the lake, and you're the most distant ripple, but it wouldn't be a pebble, it'd be one of those helicopter leaf things that drops into the lake, and then, or a butterfly, water strider's leg. But anyway, I said, well, I don't get, you know, that's too, you know, I'm hardwired for anxiety and fear, so I need something more concrete, or they'll just distract me from my lack of faith, whatever you want to frame it, Gads. So I was telling Miller about the Goonies, and I said, well, she said, wouldn't that be a good way to do it? Like, I know I'm Martha Plimpton, whose character I still... So there's Brent. Holy cow, I think we have way more characters than gods. That's a problem. I don't know who Mikey is. Crone, I think I gave you a really good role, you know, because I said, well, Crone deserves him. Were you Mikey? I don't think so. Chester is Mouth, or whatever his name is. Data... Was that you? Anyway, guys, we'll figure that part out. You know, it's not that important. It's important we adventure together. Because maybe I thought I was Mikey, because that's who I identify. I don't know if I identify with him the most either. But I guess Martha Plimpton's taking on a much bigger role in this version. So starts in kind of the, I guess they call it in the, they say, you know, the regular war, you know, regular situation at Mikey's house. Mikey and Martha and Brent, now a family of three. And Martha's the brainy sister. Mikey is, you know, is taking on a lesser role now. Whichever Gad would be Hound. Oh, I guess you're Brent Gad, Hound, so... Definitely, I think you're Brent. Mikey, so, you know, but Martha, she's found out. She's keeping it from her two brothers that the family, the place they rent, you know, they're getting, you know, the landed gentry is starting to expand their hold on the renters. Real world problem, guys. I mean, you know, my rent is like, the market's double or more. So this could be, you know, I could be dealing with this. So just pay extra attention to that part of the story, okay? And my rent's still not cheap. So just so you know, Crone, you know, if you know rental increases, don't tell me about it, because I would just curl up in a ball anyway. But so they find out, I assume, rent a place. And it looks like a nice... And I think we're in some place. Let's just say we're in Augusta, Maine, Gads. And me, Martha, the central character that everything revolves around from this point forward. I mean, there is a montage with Chunk at the beginning. That part's awesome in the Fratellis. But, you know, Martha, myself, you just call me Plimpton. No, Martha Plimpton, that sounds better together. That's why it's her name. Martha Plimpton, better together. This episode's sponsored by Martha Plimpton Incorporated. So, you know, I guess the character will be, anyway, I'm in my room. Tiger Beat is being, you know, I'm drawing nasty faces on Tiger Beat that my friend left there. Listening to some tunes, you know, I'm both brooding and, you know, being rid of, what's the,
I'm angst-ridden, so what is that if I'm being, you know, ridden with angst? And if, you know, I had overheard my parents talking about the foreclosure, so I'm, you know, I'm trying to determine. Right now I'm acting out, you know, drawing on the faces of these Tiger Beach celebrities to, you know, say, Ralph Macchio, you know, I'm gonna, you know, whatever. I'm just me, you know, bad, you know. And then Mikey comes. Maybe Mikey's hiding under my bed, because then I start to talk out loud. I start to brainstorm. You know, Mikey's always in my business, guys. Always in my business. So Brant comes in, guys, and he says, Brant, whatever Brant. I think his name might be Brant or Bran. Probably not Bran. Brant. He comes in. He says, hey, sis, what's this shaking? You know, and then he tries to do, you know, we do the deflection part, guys, but then we see how close we really are. Because, yeah, he said, tells me about his crush on Andy. I think that's you, Crone, maybe. And how, you know, she's with the rich kids at school. And how hard it is. And I said, well, Brant, man, you know, you're strapping. So you got that down, you got that going for you. Probably don't wear the shorts on outside of sweatpants. No offense. Maybe just, and, you know, just be yourself, Brant. You know, that we share a moment. And then he goes, he said, right before he says, hey, sis, it looks like you're, are you ridding yourself of angst? And I said, no, Brant, the opposite. And he says, what have you done to this Tiger Beat magazine? It looks like, and I said, well, geez, are you okay, sis? And I say, holy genuine moment. And I said, yeah, I'm okay, but I don't want to talk about it. Well, we should talk. You know, I'm cutting the chase, guys. I don't know, guys, do you use metaphors up there? Because I just, this is a metaphorical part. I'm only Martha Plimpton, okay? You're the rest of the support system. And the parents, those are like the Titans or whatever the hell, you know, that you don't, or chaos, you know. So you just pay attention for your parts here, Brant, you know, coming in and saying, well, okay, yeah, but yeah, Brant, well, I'm worried, but I don't want to talk about it. Well, you could tell me, well, I don't want Mikey to find out. And then Mikey perks up, you know, maybe Mikey was, I don't know, maybe Mikey has a crush on my friend too. And then I say, well, don't worry about it. Then the Fratellis drive by, just so you know, that was what that noise was. Maybe the Fratellis, were those internal problems I have? Maybe that was it, Gads. So then I say, well, don't tell Mikey. Okay, I won't tell Mikey. Well, we're going to lose the place. Dad's going to lose his job at the museum, you know, because of you. They said they don't want to pay property tax, but they want all the property is what I could best gather. And I see, that's why. And then they say, geez, and, you know, mom's trying to do her best. I think she's a real estate agent. It's hard. And so we're going to lose our place, the Goondocks, where all of us working class people live. And so that's it, right? That's the way of the world. And so it goes, as KV says, you know, and so it goes. And then Brant says, you know, who, what? And I say, don't worry about it, Brant. Just keep looking good. You know, get another head, change your headband. And then, you know, but Brant says, well, we should do something. And I say, well, we can't do anything. You know, we're powerless against the systematic, you know, military industrial stuff. So don't worry, don't even worry about it. We'll just, you know, I'm going to go to school and get educated. And then, you know, I'll deal with it, Brant. You're going to become, you know, one day you'll be a stockbroker. It's in the cards for you. But yeah, there's nothing we could do. We need to come up with like $80,000, you know. I guess I don't know, because we'd have to purchase these properties before the rich guys do. Or maybe they purchased our parents' mortgages. I can't remember. Did our parents have an adjustable rate mortgage and it came due? But so and then Mikey sneezes, or maybe Mikey has trouble breathing. So then we take him out. We say, oh, here's your asthma medication, Mikey. What are you doing under there?
as a brother and sister team. And Mikey says, but Mikey's playing it, guys. You know, that's the other thing. This is a fiction. So Mikey's trying to bring out even more of the best of me as Martha Plimpton. Says, well, I know about this hidden map up in the attic. And I say, okay, let me deal with it. I'm the most capable member of this family. Then Chunk and Data and Mouth show up eventually. And we leave out the other stuff, because it was kind of offensive with the poor housekeeper. I mean, not, you know, so it's just, we leave that part out. And it didn't make us say, why do we have a housekeeper if we can't pay? So we just skipped that part. We go up to the attic, all of us. And I accidentally find the map. You know, that would be some sort of divine intervention. Probably Barky. Huh, Barky, who did I cast you as? Jester is Mouth, right? Did I say that? So we got Miller, Smith, and McCrone. Not important right now, guys, you know, because you could be multi. So then, you know, the divine, the maiden, the lovely maiden, she just blows on the wind, and, you know, we find the map. Then we talk about the rich stuff. You know, then we get to the leap of faith, gods. I don't know who represents the fear within me internally, but maybe it's all of you. You're testing me. Yeah, that's it. You gods are always testing. So they say, Martha, this is a terrible idea following this thing. And then Chunk talks about the Fratellis. And then, you know, even everybody says, well, we should just give up, you know, this is the, you know, it's just like you say, Martha, and so it goes. And I say, well, geez, I'm frozen with fear too, and, you know, over analysis. But if we could combine our forces, I think, and work together, you know what, guys, no, that's wrong too. What if we just have an adventure and try? It seems scary, but what's our choice? Paralysis by analysis is my middle name, you know. Is the smart middle child. I need to change, too. So maybe we do need to do this, even if it's Brant. I know you're older and, you know, not wiser, but, and Mikey, you know, you've been pushed out of the lead role, but you'll still get your moment with Sloth. Don't worry, we'll give you that. You know, I'll find my humanity some other way. But, you know, so, yes, you're all right. What do you think? Should we just do this as an adventure? Because we don't, you know, it's a day, I think it's summer break or something anyway. Let's get our bikes and let's go and see what happens, all of us together, for fun and to see together. And then we don't ditch Brant. I guess I even forgot about that part, but you'll just come with us, Brant. Because maybe you say, Martha, what are you doing getting involved with this stuff? And Mike, you know, I got to keep an eye on Mikey anyway, because he's so... How did he end up in the lead role? Well, it's still likable. It's only likability and good acting was why. And that was before they knew they needed this, you know, because then the... Hey, Gads, no questions, please. And there we head off through the beautiful Maine afternoon, misty, shrouded in mystery. You know, there's jokes interspersed everywhere and some physical humor. And we're off on our adventure, guys. Just not a process of adventure. Yes, we were looking for certainty for poor Martha. But we know she's going to get so much more. All right, guys, that was a pretty good prayer. What do you think? So thanks for your time. Our adventure's begun. I'll make sure to get the casting right next time, guys. But anyway, Crone, sweet, sweet Crone. Miller, Smith, Barky, Jester, Hound Dog, God. Thank you for joining me on a quest. Now, you know, we got doubloons or whatever, too. All right, God, thanks. Good night. Yeah, so I'm thinking, I got a new business idea. So, well, geez, I can figure out, you know, I said, well, what if I start another wacky business? And he said, wackier than a sleep podcast. It's not, I said, yeah, wackier than a sleep podcast. It's not a business. Exactly. So I went down to Sand Hill Road. I said, ratemyresume.com. They said, get out of my office. And they said, you mean the good kind? Like you're saying, get out of town, right? And they said, well, just keep going. And I said, I already did a beta or an alpha with my own resume. So here's the ratings resume got. Or the podcast. And if you want to do that, you can go to sleepmoviepodcast.com/iTunes. I said, Motec8 said about my resume, 5 stars, fell asleep in a few minutes. Hilarious and smart. There you go. Hire me now. Oh, I'm not applying for a job. I'm applying for an investment in ratemyresume.com. I haven't heard yet a single story because I always fall asleep during the intro to the resume. And I guess you have an intro. I said, this is ratemyresume.com. Now, you could go on there and rate it if you want to rate my resume. Smart and effective. One of a kind. I said, hey, who wouldn't hire me? And he said, will the reviews be attached to your resume? I said, of course, it's a marketing thing, bro. Wouldn't come down to Sand Hill Road unless I had a great idea. How about this one? Katie Hugs Connie from, this is Australia's rating my resume, so just so you know. This resume works, 5 stars. I was skeptical, as most people are. Hardcore. Insomniac, didn't see how this resume could help me sleep, but it's funny, rambly, and no-pressure storytelling. Jenny Tope says, this resume is life-changing. Generous, 5 stars, loving gift to the world, unusual talents. Isn't this the kind of thing you want to see in a resume? Ability to multitask simultaneously and interesting and distracting works with brain bots, as they're called on the show. Boring enough you don't care to the end. Funny, gentle, thoughtful, quirky, beautiful show. Not for everyone, but if you like y'all kilter or think too much, it might be for you. Works awesome. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9 moons with an OK from the UK. Says, great resume. Hard to sleep during exams from thinking too much. This resume really helped. How about Chai Kenna, who said, my resume is surprisingly effective. 5 stars. Insomnia, tossing and turning. Weaned off of sleep aids. Other options. To take their mind off stuff, they read my resume before they tried music and TV shows, podcasts, TED Talks, but they were too interesting, and then they'd have to re-listen. Then they found Sleep With Me, Drew's resume. Crazy. Resume, not a person. Still early on, but they love it. Interested, mind doesn't wander, incoherent, no need to rewind. Pancake recipes, fence constructions, and on and on. How about this resume? Brilliant resume, sleepy in STG. That's from the UK. Thank you so much. Give it a try. Give this resume a try. It works. How about Anthony Venanzo? You could be snoozing already. Read this resume, 5 stars. You'll be asleep in minutes. How about Coco Muy Loco? It sounds like something I used to. I think I drank that a few times. It did not go well for me. I dare you to read this whole resume. I've been using this podcast to help me fall asleep for months. However, it's really difficult to explain. Rarely stay awake. Funny, likable, stream like rambling in my mind. And don't know if there's any making any progress. Inner monologue leads you to thoughts that can keep you awake. That never can keep you awake. It's a gift. I recommend it. That's a resume. How about this one? This resume will put you to sleep instantly. 5 stars. Love this resume so much. Truculent is 65. Truculent or truculent, maybe. There's nothing about my pronunciation in the reviews. M. McCall from Australia. Adore this resume and Scoots. You won't regret trying and sticking with it. Getting better at being boring in an engaging way. Oh, this one, Ray Lynn 55. That's my dad's favorite store, Ray Lynn's. I'm not kidding. Still loving this resume. 6 months now. Never not worked this resume. Certainly enjoy the distractions given to sleep. Introduction, wake up, put it on. Never listen to the whole thing, but they love the stories and the meandering. Thanks so much for being committed to my resume. How about this one? This is a good one. Flying Saucer Writer. I'd like to meet the... It says, geez, is that you, Agent Mulder? Agent Mulder, can you hear me? Flying Saucer Writer. This resume is Pied Piper of resumes. Had some stuff going on which made my sleep stuff worse. Started listening to music, but it got irritating. Then they discovered podcasts. Then they discovered this resume. And they've been sleeping with my resume ever since. Well, a copy of it, I would say. Hopefully it's on that bonded paper. Nothing like a little bonded paper at bedtime. If you ever had wanted someone just to tell you a story, like when you were a kid, that's what Scoots does. Just, that's what his resume does, too. Tells a CV, a story of his vital curriculums. He's got a gift for gab. Gabs of goop. What a wonderful resume. That's from Bookworm. Appreciate this whimsical approach to resumes, helping the listeners calm down. May seem like a criticism, but they've listened. They've never heard all the way through. Not a criticism. How about Sophie Snoozerton in the UK? Best resume ever. 5 stars. This resume is great. It's a charming, first narrated resume they've ever had that was good and charming. Recommended. Looking forward to more resumes. Well, you see, if you're looking forward to a second resume, it's probably a problem. Unless, I guess, the next time I'll leave some stuff off. How about this one? This sounds cool to hang with. Barnack 13. I think that was in a Who episode. Old Barnack 13 from the Barnacle Planet. Thank you for this resume. First review ever of a resume or a podcast. Amazing. No sleeping pills. They thought, this is a weird resume, and then fell asleep. They skipped the recaps, but they re-listened the ones they like. This is a nice sounding Laramie Esquire. It sounds like it, you know, it's like a place I'd like to live, even though it doesn't say, where do you live? What magazines do you read? Laramie Esquire magazine. The version of Esquire for those of us that smoke Laramies. This resume is cool and good. Don't write reviews, but this resume is magic powers. Least I could do is raise my hand and say, this works, this is a nice thing, and the world could... Oh, thank you. The world could use more things like this. Thank you. Life-saving resume. That's from Punk Rock Beth 43. And when they can't sleep and they're fed up, they read some resumes. And this is a resume that conked them out. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Punk Rock Beth. Weirdo Dan. Thanking you for your review from the UK. It's a truly amazing resume. It works. A great resume. It sends me to sleep. Another one from the UK. Willie Taylor, 1995. Young resume reader from the UK. Sleep With Me resume has changed the way I sleep. Love this resume. Best resume ever, because I can sleep on... Not only can I sleep because of it, I can sleep on it because it's one page. Used to have insomnia, and now I don't. Refreshing change. Funnily, winny, witty, and endlessly silly. I mean, I should put my resume on that thing, like where you dry your hands, the circular thing, so it is endless, the endless resume. Thanks. Here's something I'd like to have for dessert. Jala Mode. How you doing? Jala Mode.
Pure resume magic. Have difficulty falling asleep. Tried everything. Then I tried rating resumes. Works every single time. I have no idea how it does it, but this is my resume hero. How about this one? Malloy _ call sign BrainBots. This resume has helped me so much with falling asleep. It took a few episodes, you know, to get worse. Took 5 or 6 reads through Scoots' resume. Stick with it. If you don't get immediate results, it'll be worth it. How about this one? Rike BM from Norway. My resume's hitting it in Norway, and the ratings are coming in. Give this resume a read. It's really good. The resume's great. Worth giving a shot. If you got a busy brain and your thoughts, it's distracting and engaging, and you can drift off. Thank you. Here's another good one. Ultimate Resume Buster from Cheap Trick Roadie Trucker. So a roadie trucker works with Cheap Trick, probably. No matter how keyed up I am, this podcast puts me to sleep. Can't believe how well it works. Thanks, Cheap Trick Roadie Trucker. And then another one. This like reminds me of Tony Tone. Late Tony. Works for me. Love to fall asleep. Earring boy? How do you spell earring? I think it is earring boy. It's a tough word to read for me. Earring boy from the USA. Resume's even better when you donate $1. Thank you. Or more. Gosh, thanks, Scoots. Thank you. An overthinker rates my resume 5 stars. Grows on you. Nothing like a resume that grows on you. And indispensable. Whoa. I've been listening to 6 months. Not unusual to fall asleep in 20 minutes. Well, here's one. FCC might be called. FAA. No, the FDC. They might call about my resume. Because the great Scoop says my resume's better than drugs. Don't take that lightly. Resume is a joy, funny, wonderful, incredible. Been listening for months, convinced it would become immune, but wrong. Unlike with other stuff, you can't build up a tolerance to boring stories. You got that right. Worth $5 a month. Thank you. Every single night they listen. How about this one? DBM6745. That's a droid reviewing my resume. Unreal. 5 stars. That's a droid. That's a resume review from a droid, just so you know. Don't know how it works, but it does. Started listening before I know it, I'm sound asleep. Before resumes, I tried everything. Meditation, white noise, waves, visualization. Nothing's as effective. Also love how the sponsors are related to sleep. Awesome products. Thank you. You'll never hear the end of an episode. Can't fall asleep. This podcast, this resume can fix that. It never made it to the end. XSK1032. And this one comes from the Great White North, Canada. Author Graham says they love my resume. Amazing. A genius resume. Manages to amuse and bore. Spreading the word. And there's a chick that. Mary Ann. Thank you. This is a good one from Australia. Nicola Piccola Pickles. That is cute. And also, it sounds like a childish Nikola Tesla. Was it Tesla? Maybe this is Muskie's baby, Nikola Piccola Pickles. Say that anybody runs into Muskie, just say that to Muskie. See what he does, Nikola Piccola Pickles. I think it's probably the code to get into a secret lab. You know what didn't get me in a secret lab? My resume, but Nicola Piccola Pickles says it works like a charm. Best resume ever, thank you. And finally, rolling in here, Nona K from the USA. It's a bless to find this resume. Stops the brain bots, puts me to sleep. If you want to review my resume or the podcast, most of the podcast goes to sleepwithmepodcast.com/iTunes. Thank you so much for the support, and let's get on to the show. Oh, it's just the end of the show. Holy boy, mackerel. Anyway, thank you. And we won't be getting on a show. This is it. Good night.
All right, everybody, this is Scoots. I'm talking about tonight's sponsor, Helix Sleep. You could take that Helix Sleep quiz at helixsleep.com/sleep. I'm just about to hit my 4-year anniversary sleeping in my Helix Dusk Lux. And I took that Helix quiz. You know, I sleep on my side. I sleep on my stomach. I toss. I turn. I don't want to overheat at night. And when I took the quiz, that was the mattress it matched me with. The Helix Dusk, I chose the Helix Dusk Lux. Because Helix has like 20 unique mattresses. They've got an award-winning Lux collection, the Helix Elite collection, which is new, a mattress designed for big and tall sleepers, even a mattress made just for kids. And the way you'll know the Helix mattress works best for you and your body is to take that Helix sleep quiz at helixsleep.com/sleep. You'll find your perfect mattress in under 2 minutes. That personalized mattress will be shipped straight to your door free of charge. And Helix knows there's no better way to test out a new mattress than by sleeping it in your own home. That's why they offer a 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty to try out your new Helix mattress. Everybody's unique. Everybody sleeps differently. That's why Helix has several different mattress models to choose from, each designed for specific sleep positions and feel preferences. There's models with memory foam layers to provide optimal pressure relief if you sleep on your side, models with a more responsive foam to cradle your body for essential support in stomach and back sleeping positions. Plus, there's enhanced cooling features for people like me, keep us from overheating at night. If your spine needs that extra TLC, they got you. Every Helix mattress has a hybrid design combining comfort and support. I took the Helix sleep quiz. Like I said, I got matched with the Helix Dusk. I wanted something with the right firmness that I could sleep on my stomach, my side, even my back. And they kept me from overheating. And it fits the bill. And not only is it the best mattress I've slept on, the setup was fast and easy. Helix mattresses are delivered in a box straight to your door for free. Plus, all Helix mattresses come with a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And if you don't want to take my word for it, Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine. It's even recommended by multiple leading chiropractors and doctors. The sleep medicine is a go-to solution for improving your sleep. And Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/sleep and use the code HELIXPARTNER20. That's HELIXPARTNER20, one word. This is the best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. Support for Sleep With Me comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting your time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/withme. That's odoo.com/withme. Odoo, modern management made simple.